All right, everyone, we are going to go ahead and get started with our webinar this morning. Good morning, afternoon, or evening, everyone, and thank you very much for joining today. On behalf of the AgriLinks team, I would like to welcome you to the June AgriLinks webinar on soil variation and why it matters in the agricultural development space. Our speakers today are from the Feed the Future Innovation Lab for Assets and Market Access, which is also known as the AMA Innovation Lab. This innovation lab is managed by the Bureau for Food Security's Markets and Partnerships Innovation Office in order to support research on inclusive market access and risk management. And the results of this Feed the Future Innovation Lab and other innovation labs, the results support the goal and objectives of the Global Food Security Strategy, which, as you all know, is a very important guiding principle for the government's agricultural development programming moving forward. And as such, we are very excited to be able to disseminate research findings from the AMA Innovation Lab through today's webinar. Before we get started with the content, I'd like to provide just a couple of reminders. First, the chat box is your main way to communicate today, and I see that many of you have already taken advantage of the chat box on the bottom right of your screen. Thanks to everyone who's introduced yourselves. It's always really fun to see that we've got a global audience for these webinars. And throughout the webinar, we encourage you to use the chat box to network, to share links and resources, and to ask any questions about the presentations. We will hold most of those questions until after the presenters have presented today, and then ask them during a Q&A portion of the webinar. Next, you'll see on the left of your screen a variety of recommended resources in the resources box and the links box at the bottom left. So we encourage you to download throughout the webinar today. And we are also recording this webinar and will post the recording, a transcript, and other resources to AgriLinks within 2 weeks. If you are watching the webinar right now, that means you're already on the email list to receive a link to the recording. So be on the lookout for that. And I believe I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a Knowledge Management Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And I'll be facilitating the webinar today, kind of keeping things moving and collecting your questions. And I also wanted to mention that AgriLinks webinars are produced and managed by the Feed the Future KDAD project, which stands for Knowledge-Driven Agricultural Development. So thank you very much to that team for helping to make these webinars happen. All right, it is time to dive into the content and discuss a topic that is very fundamental to all agriculture and food security activities, which is soil, soil types, soil variability, and the various inputs that can help improve soil prospects for smallholder farmers. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our three speakers today and then pass it off to them. All right, so we have a great panel of speakers during this webinar today. And first up is Amelia Chirenstrom from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she is an assistant professor of public affairs and agricultural and applied economics. Her research draws on insights from behavioral economics and employs econometrics, field and lab experiments to study technology diffusion. So she will kick us off today. And then next up will be Hope Mickelson, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She has her PhD in applied economics from Cornell, and her research in the developing world centers on relationships among agriculture, poverty, and market institutions. She will be our second presenter, and Carolina Corral will be our third presenter. She is with the Precision Agriculture for Development Kenya project, which is also known as PAD. And she has has her MSc in economics from the University of Montreal and more than 10 years' experience in applied economic research, managing projects in Latin America, Africa, and many other locations. And PAD, her organization, is a nonprofit with the mission to support smallholder farmers in developing countries with personalized agricultural advice through their mobile phones. So that is our panel. But kicking off with a few introductory remarks is Michael Carter with the University of California, Davis, professor of agricultural and resource economics. and the director of the Feed the Future Innovation Lab for Assets and Market Access, or the AMA Innovation Lab. So we would love to have Michael unmute his line and kick us off for this webinar.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Julie, and thank you to everyone. I'll say just a very few words by way of introduction for what we're about to hear. So the way I think about this event is, in a sense, what we're talking about is the green revolution that was not. So I suspect most of us have seen data on cereal yields and fertilizer use stretching 1960 forward. And if you look at that kind of data, what you see is South Asia, East Asia, Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, we're all at very similar level 1960. And then as you roll the clock forward, the other regions of the developing world show very sharp rates of increase in cereal yields matched by very sharp rates of increase in the use of inorganic fertilizers. And so one of the questions is always to see fertilizer revolution in sub-Saharan Africa. Why didn't it happen in the same way that it seems to have happened in most other parts of the world? Economists, amongst others, have their own sort of favorite explanations. Economists might focus on liquidity constraints or risk. I've always thought it's important to ask ourselves what's different, why this sort of sub-Saharan African exceptionalism. One kind of perspective that's emerged from of people who study this intensively is that there's something different about African soils. So an extreme version of that hypothesis would be that African soils just are not very fertilizer responsive. Organic matter is perhaps really low. There simply are not the preconditions, the biophysical preconditions, the agronomic conditions for the seed fertilizer revolution to work. Another possibility, and this really gets us to what we're going to talk about, is it's perhaps not so much the average level of fertilizer responsiveness of soils, but rather the variability of soils that is the issue. So the studies we're at today share a common characteristic in that they all look at hyper-local variation in soil quality. And they're really looking at a series of interrelated questions. So the first is how much of that sort of hyper-local soil variation is there, and does it matter in the sense that a farmer in one location really has soils are sufficiently different than a nearby farmer such that a standardized Green Revolution recommendation, use this much nitrogen, use this seed variety, is maybe just not going to work. So that's the first element we're going to, I think all three studies are going to talk to us about today. And the next thing is, what do you do about it? If there is this kind of hyper-local variation, what are the kinds of interventions that might be possible? Is simply the provision of information sufficient, or are there other kinds of matching interventions that need to be made such that farmers can actually profitably adopt their own particular, if you will, variation of the seed fertilizer variation? So Amelia is going to be sharing information with us on a study in Western Kenya. Caro is talking about some work initially in Mexico, which is now spilling over into Eastern Africa, and Hope will talk to us about work she and her colleagues have been doing in Tanzania. And I think our job here as an audience is, as we go through this material with them, is to sort of ask ourselves, what, if anything, can be done to promote the uptake of the technologies which are there and which seem to hold out such promise, and yet which seem not to have been adopted in this environment of, as we'll see, a fairly extreme soil heterogeneity. So without further ado on my part, Amelia, why don't we pass it over to you, and I look forward to the conversation with all of us who have joined.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Good morning, everyone, or, you know, good evening, depending on where you are in the world. I've been asked to just remind participants that if you want to see the presentation up on the full screen, then you can click the four arrows in the top right-hand corner of your presentation display, and that'll make it a full screen window. And so I want to start off the morning with talking about some data that we collected in Kenya together with Tegemeo Institute in Nairobi, and I'm really excited to see some of them present in, and I don't know why the screen is moving. in the chat today. Anyway, so what I want to do is talk a little bit about what I think the data has taught us about the level at which soil quality characteristics vary, and what that variability means in terms of both how to think about what the optimal input package looks like for smallholder farmers, in terms of how farmers' ability to learn might about what is optimal for them, as Michael mentioned, sort of varies with the extent of soil variability, and also in terms of the extent to which this variability slows adoption of improved inputs for farmers. Now, I think that will set up Hope and Caro really nicely, because they're then going to talk about ways in which we can sort of leverage information about soils to maybe increase adoption about of improved materials. So some of the reasons that we might care about soil heterogeneity, right? I think many of you listening would agree that increasing the use of improved germplasm and fertilizer could boost the yields and the welfare of rural households. And there are lots of smart and passionate people who work in the government sphere, researchers, NGOs, who work on ways to increase adoption of these inputs. And common approaches include things like input subsidies, extension services, and, you know, government-issued input recommendations. But it's really hard to provide good recommendations and trainings when soils vary a lot, right? So one important question becomes sort of how low do we go, right? How low do we need to go? At what level do we have enough similarity that providing a single recommendation should suffice? So for a country like Kenya, are we talking about 10 agroecological zones for which we might want to make different recommendations? Are we talking about 100 more? And so I want to start by looking at some maps and thinking a little bit about this issue, because at least I was quite surprised when we started digging into this data. And then I'll move to talking a bit about what the consequences might be for farmers of this type of variability. So to give you a sense, let me show you some maps. So on the left-hand side is Kenya. The red zone there is the former province of Nyanza. It was an administrative unit. And the right-hand side sort of zooms in on the part of this province that lies south of Lake Victoria, so South Nyanza. And this colorful map comes from the 2009 version of the Farm Management Handbook of Kenya. And so you can see that there's been a lot of careful work here going into defining different agroecological zones based on rainfall, the length of the growing season, et cetera, right? I'm going to show you another map of the same region where the different colors and these different rectangles show different areas within which different fertilizer recommendations have been made, okay? And so within these different sections, you can sort of pull up a zoomed-in version and find a table within this handbook and look up fertilizer recommendations for that specific zone, okay? So this is partly to say that it's not as though local variability in the environment hasn't been considered before, but what if these are not still not local enough, right? Note the scale here, that this rectangle on the right-hand side is sort of 10 to 20 kilometers across, okay? And so we're going to look at our data to kind of think about whether or not there's important variability even within these types of zones. And so our data, these maps show the GPS locations of our sample farmers, and they were collected for a study on the socioeconomic impacts of a new maize hybrid. But as part of the data collection, we sampled the fields of 1,800 farm households and sent them to be tested, sent the soil samples to CropNuts, which is an ISO-certified lab in Nairobi. And we obtained over 20 different measures, so ranging from pH, organic matter, a bunch of different nutrients and micronutrients, and the cation exchange capacity, which I'll come back to in a second. So as you can see, we have a pretty broad geographical spread in our sample, but let me, for the sake of comparison, zoom in to South Nyanza again, roughly. This map here shows the GPS locations of our different households in this area and shows a distribution of cation exchange capacity. It's often used as a measure to gauge soil fertility. And sorry, my map is my presentation is moving. So if someone else is moving that, maybe avoid doing that. But so cation exchange capacity is important because it affects farmers. It affects optimum practices. And this is just one example. But for example, liming recommendations, fertilizer efficiency, and even the optimal timing of fertilizer applications all vary with soil CEC. Okay, so I'm going to zoom in even more and look at a couple of villages in our sample. And so the different dots here, the colors of those dots represent different ranges of cation exchange capacity. And this correlates with, as I said, different soil types, different optimum practices. And so note that across just a couple of villages here, we have fields that fall into both very low range, low, medium, and high ranges of CEC. And so even within a village, soil quality can vary quite a bit. And so if you note the scale, it might actually be difficult because my presentation, we have some technical difficulties, and so it's a little bit wonky, but bear with me. That bar in the lower right-hand side corner in that red rectangle shows a 1 kilometer scale. So this scale here is basically incredible variation within just a few kilometers of each other, right? And so even within a village, as I said, soil quality can vary quite a bit. I'm going to show some other examples of this. This is across all of our 100 plus villages, the variation in cation exchange capacity again. And so each bar on this graph is a box plot. And if you can see it, there's a white line in the middle of each bar, which shows you the median CEC value in that village. While the height of the bars represent the amount of variability within that village, essentially. Okay, but there's also big differences between different villages in terms of how much variation there is. So if we zoom in on two villages that have the same median CEC, you can see that in one of these villages, a 25th percentile farmer looks very different from a 75th percentile farmer, whereas in the other village, the distribution is sort of much more compressed. And we can see the same thing for other soil characteristics. For this graph shows pH. This graph shows organic matter, and so you see lots of variability both between and within villages and in the extent of variability. So the logical next question here is obviously whether this matters for input recommendations and for optimum practices. And so in particular, does the optimal fertilizer recommendation vary at this sort of hyperlocal scale, and might recommendations for a median farmer in a village potentially be misleading for other farmers, and certainly at the sort of, you know, 20 kilometer or regional scale? And so the short answer to the first question is that yes, it seems like the optimal input varies quite a lot within village. Our soil testing lab also provided each of our farmers with a recommendation for the optimal input application for a variety of fertilizers, and there are substantial differences within villages. These graphs show 20 random villages and the recommended level of DAP per acre for those samples. And so the two blue circles here show that for some farmers, the ideal application rate might be 20 kilograms per acre, and for others, it might be as much as 40, which may not sound like a lot, but it can have very important profit implications if you're a smallholder and you're deciding how to allocate a limited budget. Okay? So we can also see this. We have the same graphs for a variety of fertilizers, but I don't want to bore you with that. So we can also look at this in a different way by estimating production functions and, you know, slightly more advanced econometric techniques, and try to estimate based on a panel of three rounds of survey data what the returns to fertilizer look like and how they change with the underlying soil qualities and types. On the right-hand side here, the graph, so we use a quadratic production, a generalized quadratic for those who are econometric geeks. We have household fixed effects. And so you can see that on the left-hand side, for certain levels of CEC, the average marginal benefit of adding another kilo of nitrogen is substantial, whereas for other ranges of CEC, it seems like on average, the returns to more nitrogen are quite low. We have these graphs again for a lot of different soil conditions, but it seems like the returns to an additional kilo of nitrogen vary markedly with soil conditions. Now, this could be because, and as I think Hope will talk about, other nutrients are more limiting in certain contexts, or because of acidity, or because of a variety of different issues. But in general, it does seem like the ideal fertilizer recommendation varies with soil quality. Okay. So to kind of loop back to the things we really care about, we sort of think about what, you know, whether this could be part of the reason that the adoption of improved inputs is so low in sub-Saharan Africa. And so I have some other work showing that learning through social networks by farmers, you know, basically learning from their neighbors, is substantially weaker in villages with more soil quality variation. Okay, so this is somewhat logical, right? Because when soils vary more, the experience that one farmer has with improved inputs doesn't necessarily provide a good example for other farmers who may have a different soil type, as I showed you earlier. And it does seem like farmers are acutely aware of this issue. They, because of the fact that they learn worse in more heterogeneous villages, we can sort of infer that one of the reasons for this reduced learning ability is that soils vary so much. And so this really suggests that the types of localized interventions and recommendations and very specific information that the next presenters are going to talk about can play a really important role. And with that, I think I'm going to hand it over to the next presenter.
Hi, hello. Thanks, Amelia. So this is Hope Michelson. I'm from the University of Illinois. And so I'm gonna, it's lovely to follow Amelia and Michael because they set up our work, I think, so well. And I think some of the things that we're doing can really complement Amelia has just talked about. So as Michael noted, this is work that's been done in Tanzania. We're just finishing up. And it's with a really big group of people that I want to acknowledge. So a whole team of soil scientists at Sokoine University in Morogoro, as well as folks at Columbia, University of Florida, and now we have one researcher who's at McGill. So as Michael noted, and
Adam in DC, can you just speak up a little bit, please? You're a little bit faint. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. Back to you.
Yes. Okay. All right. Wait. Let me turn one thing off. There's a background air conditioner that might be making things worse. Okay. All right. All right. Let me know if this doesn't sound better. Okay.
We could use a little more oomph if you got it, but if not, that's fine. We can live. Hope is presenting in a different location from us. You might just need to turn off the sound on your computer. Thank you.
Okay. So as Michael noted and as Amelia stressed, you know, there's this problem that many people have been thinking about for a long time, which is that mineral fertilizer use, as well as other sort of advanced inputs, agricultural inputs, has really lagged in sub-Saharan Africa, and we see an associated lag in crop yields, especially among small farmers. And so just to reiterate, right, there are sort of three reasons that we think soil variation can be important here if we find that it's significant enough, right, that there's enough variation, right? And the three reasons that we think about a lot, right, is that you're going to need sub-regional calibration of fertilizer and management recommendations, right? So Tanzania in particular is not like Kenya, where you've got these sub-regional kind of carefully calibrated recommendations. Tanzania is making broader recommendations for whole regions for maize cultivation, right? And there's a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have that kind of a strategy. And so if we find that there's enough soil variation and that soil variation is meaningful agronomically, we really need to think about how we're going to get recommendations to people that are appropriate, right? And so the second point is related to something that Amelia has talked about and also thought about a lot, which is that if you've got this within village farmer heterogeneity, variation in soils, learning about technologies is going to be compromised in some ways. There's going to be a bit different. And that's something that if you have an extension system, you're going to want to think about pretty carefully, right? So if you're in a place where you've got very similar soils, you might expect different kinds of learning dynamics, different kinds of spillovers among your farmers. Whereas if you're in a place where you've got a lot of variation, that process may not happen, or it may not happen as quickly. Right? And the third piece, which I think about a lot in an associated project, is if you've got all of this important variation, you're going to have a demand for a wide variety of agricultural inputs, right? So in particular, fertilizer blends. And you're going to need well-capacitated agricultural input supply chains to actually meet those needs, right? So they're going to have to be well-resourced. They're going to have to be able to supply the blends to the right places, to the right people. And so some work that I have suggests that, at least in Tanzania, we may not be there quite yet. Okay. All right. So the three questions that I'm going to talk about are thinking about this localized variation. So I'll show you in Tanzania what we're seeing in this one region where we're working, and I'll show you that in a slightly different way than Amelia was talking about it. and then we, as a part of the intervention for this project, are providing information to farmers about their soils and specific management recommendations based on that, the soil test. And then we're looking at what the effect is of that, of providing them information in a couple of different ways on what farmers decide to buy and then the yields that they're getting from me. Okay. And then I'll also, we're beginning to think about this third question that Amelia also talked about, which is the how low should you go question, right? So what's the optimal scale for soil testing? And the reason we're thinking about that is that in conversations with people that we're having who think about this on the policy side, the first question we get, right? So do we need to test at the field level? Do we need to test at the village level? What's the right way to think about providing this information to farmers? So so just to explain the experiment that we're doing before I show you any of the results. So we're working in eastern Tanzania in Morogoro, and we tested the primary maize plots for 1,100 farmers, small-scale maize farmers. So we randomly selected the villages, and there's two components to the treatment. So there's a plot-specific management recommendation. So we tested their primary maize plot, and I'll tell you how we did that on the next slide. And then we had management recommendations based on those test results. And there's also a voucher worth $40, which was redeemable for agricultural inputs. And that is the amount that it costs to buy the inputs currently recommended by the government for maize production in that region for half of an acre. That's how that number came about. So we took those two components of the treatment, and we have three treatment arms. So farmers either received the soil management recommendations, they got the management recommendations and the voucher, or they only got the voucher, right? So you can think about that as information only, information plus liquidity, or liquidity only. And then we had a control group that's both within the villages and also separate villages that were control villages, so we can look at spillovers. And they received the management recommendations as well. We tested their plots as well, but they received them at end line, right? So you can see what happens to folks that did get those things as opposed to people that didn't. So just a moment explaining what we're using to do the testing. So this is called the Soil.Kit. It was developed by Ray Weil from the University of Maryland. And the cost of the test using this kit, which gives you measures of CEC, pH, N, PEK, S, a range of other parameters, is about $5 right now, although that doesn't include the time associated with the testing. So it's significantly less than a sort of wet lab measure. Also, this is designed to be able to be done in the field with the farmer, so you also don't have that time lag that you often have between the testing and the provision of the information. We didn't do it like that because we wanted to sort of have scale, and so we used the Soil.Doc protocols, but we use them in a lab at Silk Running University. So if people have questions about that, I can answer it at the end. This is where our farmers are located. So the blue dots are treatment fields, our treatment farmers, and our red dots are control fields. As I said, we're in eastern Tanzania in the Morogoro region, and you can see the nice kind of coincident coverage of the treatment and control groups there. So I'll also show you, so this is the recommendation sheet. You're getting the details right on this kind of an intervention is really important. So this was a recommendation sheet given to farmers who were deficient in sulfur and nitrogen, and it's in Swahili. Recs are provided to each farmer for both 1 acre and half of an acre. So the cost of this packet was about 65,000 shillings at the time. And then here's a picture of what the voucher looked like. So it was an 80,000 shilling voucher. And one thing to note that people can ask about later is that they were allowed to just turn it in for cash. So if they turned it in for cash, they got 85% of the value of the voucher. So let's talk about some results then. As I said, I'm going to show you things in a slightly different way than Amelia, and it's related to the way that we did the management recommendations from the soil testing. So so I'll show them to you spatially, and then I'll show them to you in a table form. So this is similar to the map that Amelia showed you, with one difference. So each dot is a field. And then in the right side, the lower right corner key, what we've got are the management recommendations according to specific combinations of nutrient deficiencies that came out of the soil testing. So the sort of the top one is farmers that were only deficient, only limited in nitrogen, and then farmers that were limited in nitrogen and potassium, and then you can go down from there. So you can think about as you get lower, those fields are deficient in more nutrients, right? This is within 120 square mile area. You see that fields exhibit 8 different combinations of nutrient limitations. And you can also see that, you know, within the villages, which are these sort of clusters of points, they're marked by triangles, but difficult to see, I think, that there's a lot of variation in what those specific combinations of nutrient limitations are, right? And that's very important because these nutrient limitations are related to the kinds of fertilizers you need to buy, the kinds of applications you need to make, when you make those applications, and the blends that you need to purchase, right? So if you're thinking about what an extension service needs to think about, what a, you know, an input dealer needs to have on hand, that's a lot of variability in a practical sense to be trying to sort of meet the demand there. Okay, so the other way to think about this, the other way to present this is as a table. So there's 1,000 fields here in the table, and it's the same information. But what I'm showing you is the nutrient deficiency and then the number of farms and the share of farms in the far right column. And what I want you to note, the additional piece of information here is, well, first, just a breakdown across the different limitations. And you can see sulfur is highly limiting for the majority of farmers in our sample. What's interesting, so the government recommended application for maize grower in the region is NP, which I've highlighted in red. And so that means that's appropriate to the nutrient limitation of only 5 farmers in our sample. And in particular, the government's not saying anything about sulfur, and that's a very highly limiting nutrient for nearly all of the farmers in the sample. So an important thing to think about. Okay, so what I'm showing you in this graph then is we're going to get into the results of the effects of the intervention. So remember, there's 3 treatment groups. Voucher, so getting some liquidity, the recommendation, and then the combination of those things. Okay. So what this is showing you is just in a discrete way, what did people buy if they got those different, if they were assigned to those different treatment arms, right? So one thing to note, so the first bullet point there is that only 8 of the farmers in our sample had applied mineral fertilizer at baseline. So extremely low baseline usage rates. And that was very surprising even to us. That was lower rates than we expected to see. So at MN, we've got about 250 farmers buying fertilizer. And farmers who are receiving the vouchers or the recommendations plus the vouchers are the ones where we're seeing some movement, right? So the ones who just got the information alone without that liquidity infusion, we're not seeing making any purchases, at least yet, right? So this is something Michael and I talked about a couple days ago. So you could look at that slide and you could say, okay, well, it looks like, you know, farmers are buying either urea and sulfur or urea and DAP or only urea. And a lot of farmers are buying only urea, right? So if you're giving this information and these vouchers to farmers and they're just going out and buying urea, how important is that? How useful is that to actually solving the nutrient limitations that they have on their fields? And so one thing to note here, which is interesting and important, is that there is a special value of the information. So farmers that got the vouchers and the information were much more likely to buy fertilizers that related to their nutrient deficiencies. So in particular, as I said before, sulfur was a primary limitation for a majority of these farmers. And so what I have down here in the small table is just a linear probability model regressing the interactions of being sulfur deficient with your treatment, right, status. And you can see that the big effect here, right, so you're much more likely to actually buy ammonium sulfate fertilizer if you were given information that you were sulfur deficient and you had the voucher and recommendation tree. Okay, so that's telling us potentially some information that information can help close those farm-specific nutrient deficiency gaps. So I think that's important to know. Okay, so now I'm going to show you two graphs that are the effects. So we talked about what the sort of discrete effects are on buying or not buying fertilizer. So this is how much fertilizer you bought if you were in the different treatment arms of the intervention. And then the next graph I'll show you yield effects. So here what you're seeing is on the y-axis is the kilos of mineral fertilizer. So we're just lumping all the mineral fertilizer together here. And on the x-axis, the different treatment arms. And so you can see that the big effect that we're seeing, so people who were who received the rec and the voucher bought about 12 to 13 kilos of mineral fertilizer. Right? We also see an effect on the voucher only. They bought about 7. Those are statistically different from each other. Right? But as you can expect from the previous slide, there's almost nothing on recommendation only. And then correspondingly, we see an effect, although it's a small effect, on the yields, the maize yields of the group that got the recommendation and the voucher. So our yield measure is pretty noisy, and we're doing some work to see if we can control for some of that variation in a better way. But so right now we're only seeing that effect map into that group. So in terms of preliminary conclusions, there's a few things that I want to stress. So we do see considerable variation, I would say, in soil nutrient deficiencies in nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and sulfur. and our results clearly demonstrate that the national level fertilizer recommendations are not serving a number of farmers, at least in this region. Right? So vouchers alone seem to move farmers to purchase mineral fertilizer, but it's information plus vouchers that seem to be important for closing farm-specific nutrient gaps. But it's important to note also that those financial constraints are significant. So information provision alone is not yet changing investment. That doesn't mean that it wouldn't in the future. Farmers could be holding back and waiting to see what's happening, but we don't see that at the end line, which is the year after the information is provided. We also see pretty limited information flow. I didn't present these results, but control farmers living in the treatment villages, right? So looking to see whether or not those guys are different from control farmers living in control villages, we don't see any difference for them. So it's not that farmers yet are sort of swapping this information around. Part of that could be related to what Amelia has suggested and what Kyla Munshi has found, that there's a lot of, that learning can be really limited in highly variable villages. We don't see a lot of an effect on yields. There's something to talk about here in terms of fertilizing maize and the profitability of doing that. I want to stress this idea that areas with evidence of agronomically important variation in soil quality, it may be important to think about farm-level soil testing and management recommendations. So that brings me to my last point in the last slide I'm going to show you. In terms of future work, I think there's interesting questions about how these dynamics change over time, what learning looks like across farmers, and whether effects stay, whether they increase, attenuate. So Cara is going to talk about some of that. Those questions in her. So the last slide that I want to leave you with is we're also thinking about this question of the optimal scale for soil testing. We're thinking about it at this point in more of a in sort of a statistical way, where we're just trying to think about, okay, what are the places that have the most variation, and can we predict which places have the most variation based on observable sort of structural characteristics that we can get from publicly available data. So that's what we're thinking about. The idea being that there's variability in the variability, right? And this, understanding that variability can be very important for figuring out where to deploy the resources for more field-level testing versus where to maybe spend less resources and to do testing at the village level or the cluster level, right? So this is some initial work that we're doing where we're looking at the electrical conductivity and And what this is suggesting, so on the left, we've got the actual measures. This is similar to the box plots that Amelia was showing you of soil electrical conductivity. On the right, what we've taken is we've taken our data and just randomly put the farmers into villages, right? And then we're comparing what those distributions look like. So what this is telling you and what we're seeing across a number of the measures is that there is something structural, right, within at the village level, right? So the values tend to be tighter, the variability tends to be smaller at the village level in our data than it is if you just randomly group the villages together. So that I think that's hopeful in some sense, because it suggests that there's some kind of structure that might allow us to, in some places, not have to do the expensive kind of field level testing for assessing variability. So I'm going to pass it off to Caro, and thanks very much.
Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. So thank you so much to Amelia and Hope. You have done half of my presentation, so I can go very fast now. So thank you for that. Like, I'm going to present to you our research that is done in Mexico. The work was done together with Xavi Chini from the World Bank, Aparajit Mahaman from UC Berkeley, and Enrique Seiras from ITAM in Mexico. I want to mention two very important actors that are not mentioned at the beginning. One is Dr. Javier Castellanos. He's our soil scientist. He has been working for us for the past 3 years. He's now helping me in our work with Precision Agriculture for Development in Kenya. And at the same time, you will see how important was the role of the agricultural extension workers and also the agro dealers. So our work starts very similar grants that the two presentations you have just seen. Basically, we start with this question about, we have all these amounts of, as Michael was saying at the beginning, there is all this technology that was developed in different research centers that is working to increase yields, but however, many years have happened, and we don't see that small farmers are adopting these technologies. So one of these reasons could be this, what we are discussing today, which is the heterogeneity on the soil. So we wanted to focus in Mexico because although there are like many regions in the country that they have like yields comparable to the U.S. standards, there are many other regions in the country that actually are very close, similar to the productivity that we observe in Africa, like maybe not so much higher. For example, in Tlaxcala, where we did the study, the average productivity of our farmers is about 2 tons per hectare, which is not that far away from Africa. So what is our project? We want to better understand what are the causes of the heterogeneity, and we want to focus on soil quality. We want to use very high quality data on soil analysis. I will talk briefly about what are the considerations we need to think when we are talking about soil analysis. This is the whole world behind that. And also using this information from soil analysis and high quality data from basements and surveys from these farmers, we want to develop interventions that actually from the beginning, from the design, they should be successful. Like, basically, we try to develop interventions that are so well founded on agricultural theory, but also in behavioral theory, that from the beginning we expect that if farmers try them, they are going to be successful. So what we focus on is, as you have just seen, like evidence from other countries in Africa, we see the same. We perform 3,000 chemical analyses using wet chemistry with a very renowned lab. A laboratory in Mexico. We see exactly the same that Hope and Emilia saw. Large variation both within and across clusters. We have 27 clusters of localities in Tlaxcala, and we see high variations in micronutrients. Those are nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. We don't see that much variation in micronutrients, and I think it's interesting, and probably if there is someone in the audience who has expertise on that, maybe that person can put comments about it. And we know that if we have high soil variation, we cannot expect that input packages will perform the same. Okay, same problem we have just seen. Okay, so now I will tell you what we did to solve the problem. Like from the implementation issue, so we observed this problem. So what we did is like we performed more than thousands of soil analysis, and based on the results of those soil analysis, we provided individual and average recommendations. I'm going to talk a little more in deeply in a second about what is an average recommendation. We also provided income grants, and we provided flexible and unflexible. So in the unflexible grant, basically we told the farmers that they could pick an input package that was a fertilized recommendation, but also we provided machinery. And we said, first you have to do, you have to get your planting package right, and then move forward into the second package. And one of the things, the reason for that is like, especially in Tlaxcala, only 10 to 12% of our farmers were applying fertilizers at planting. And the reason for that is because Tlaxcala has like a lot of different weather risks. So they face, for example, drought, they face, for example, frost. And so a way that farmers have adapted with time for that is to wait and to apply the first round of fertilizers. What that happens is like for the first 30 days, the plant is not receiving the right nutrients, and obviously that has like a high impact in the total yield. And the third part of the implementation was provided agricultural extension services to the farmers. We combined this into four treatments and a control arm. I'm not going to talk about the treatment now. I want to actually go more in detail to explain you where were like the different parts of the interventions that we had to solve at each step. And then when I show you the results of adoption, I will explain you a little bit more of why we did that evaluation design. So for the input implementation, we did something that is different, and I haven't seen that much in the literature. In order to calculate these input recommendations, we set up a yield target. So, and the reason for this is target, it was because sometimes when you're thinking what input recommendation you should work with, like the first question is how much you want to produce. And then in order to get to that optimal, then you subtract the amount of nutrients that are supplied by the soil, and then you provide a recommendation out of it. So, all this calibration model was done by Fertilab, which is a renowned the lab that I was talking in Mexico using webcam. And for people that are like from economics, basically for when we're talking to economists, what is behind all these recommendations is just like a Lyonsev production model. For agronomists, this is like the EF law of minimums, which does mean that your expected productivity depends on the nutrients that you're lacking the most. We also recommend doses for urea, DIP, potassium chloride, and also include micronutrients because we observe high deficiency. There's a large body of literature from the agricultural scientists that basically are like talking about these micronutrients. You don't seem to need like that many amounts of kilograms, but actually they have like high impact on yields at the end of the day. We also provided information about prices, quantities, and total cost for each input package. That was called the shopping list. In the recommendations, we also provide information about how much and the price that you should use, but we also compare that information to their own use of fertilizers. So, someone moved something. Okay, I don't know what happened. Okay, please move. So one thing that is very important about fertilizer application, as I said a second ago, is the timing of the fertilization. So that's something that we saw evidence. I'm not going to present it in here. So what's happening is like the plant really needs the fertilizers to be applied at different process stages. If the farmers don't do that and they apply it maybe later, they are not going to see the same impact. So we were talking a lot about the timing of the fertilization, and we were talking about it in terms of the number of leaves the plants have and the number of days after planting. So another part of the recommendations was to provide, actually we were recommending the use of precision sowing drills, and we explained to farmers that it was very important that there was the right space in between seeds in order to guarantee that once the fertilizer is applied, actually the plants can try to avoid the plants competing within each other. And the second thing, the last thing that we also recommend, we didn't support with the grant, was the use of service beds. Because I think it's very important to mention, it's like sometimes when we're talking about all these problems, we forget to mention, like, you know, what could be negative externalities of the use of fertilizers, and which is one of them. So the nutrient fertilizer recommendation, we saw that there is like substantial variation both in the soil analysis and depending in which localities, that was translated into a variation to recommendations. In some other localities, it was not, because it depends like on many different factors that we took into account for the calculations. Once we have this translation into the fertilizer recommendations, one of the things that we realized is that farmers that were using with the same amount of money that we're investing in urea, they could be doing much better if they were to apply a more diverse fertilizer package. So when I was talking about this average soil analysis, so we have this situation where the government, for example, in Kenya, they are offering blanket recommendations. The same is true in Mexico. The government is offering blanket recommendations to the farmers. So what we are trying to do is try to improve this blanket recommendation and trying to be more precise about what is the level of aggregations of soil analysis. So what we did is out of clusters that they would depend on size, they were like about between 5 to 10 kilometers, square kilometers. We were going to, first what we did is basically we calculate the average soil analysis for that particular cluster, and then we provide average recommendations based on this average soil analysis. So what we find from out of that is that the blend ended up being a little bit cheaper than the customized, that the individual, let's say the blend based on the individual soil analysis. The reason for that is because DAP, which is like one of the main components of the blend, and it's more expensive, that there was some variation we were calculating that. And then finally, we work with agro dealers to actually mix, like perform these physical mixes. In theory, you don't need that. Like you could have farmers actually, farmers can do their own blend just by buying the different fertilizers. The reason why we did it is because we wanted to be sure that the blend was performed in the right amount. Because we were trying to calculate where were the returns to these mixes. So this is a map of Tlaxcala. So Tlaxcala is a very small state, it's close to Mexico City. And one of the things that is very interesting about the soils in Tlaxcala is that we have this big mountain called La Malinche, and all our localities that are planting maize are actually surrounded, you cannot see it in the map, but this is a small white area in between the green area. And depending on the size of the mountain that your plot is located, the soils actually are expected to change a lot, and the same is true for the height that these plots are located. So this is one of the poorest states in Mexico. 88% of this is rainfall dependent. And in our sample group, like pretty much farmers, 40% of our sample have not finished primary school, and the land tenure is smaller than in other regions. So what are our results? We make all these efforts to try to understand all this agricultural theory. We got the economists to think through all this information, shopping lists, prices. We were talking about efficiency to farmers. We were talking about the quality of the fertilizers to farmers. So what do we see? So we see that for 2015, that was the year that the intervention took place, we see the farmers did what we asked. So for example, what we see is like, we recommended less urea. Yes, they did less urea. We recommended a little bit less of DAP. Yes, they did a little bit less of DAP. We see that there are adoption in potassium chloride that they were not using before. We see adoption on the potassium chloride. And overall, we see that they use less fertilizer, no more. And however, when we look at self-reported yields, we see that actually that we were seeing increases between 16 and 22%. So the first question that you will have about this table is, yes, but you didn't reach the 4.5 ton yield, Caro. Yes, it's true. Because after all that effort, we got a drought that lasted about 30 days. So this result shows that even under a very bad drought, all the treatments were performing better. So what is the difference between treatments that I have not explained and I promise to explain you now is, so treatment one was the treatment that was forced to use precision machinery at planting, but we provided personalized recommendations and blends for that particular plot. People who were in treatment two were people who were forced to use the precision machinery and planting, but they were provided with average input packages, okay? With support for them. Actually, our grant only covered the first, the machinery, the first package, and a small part of the second package that they used for top dressing. Treatment three is the most interesting one for us, because in treatment three, we provided the information to the farmers that they could do whatever they wanted. So they could use the precision machinery for planting plus the fertilizer recommendation for planting, and or they could use the money to exchange it for only fertilizers blends, or they could even go and change it for whatever they want at the agrobet. So it could be just urea, just DAP, just whatever they wanted. And in treatment four, they had all the training the rest of the farmer had. They have recommendations that were average, but they didn't receive any financial support. So what we see is that obviously the impact is coming from, it seems to be the case that the grant is helping for people for adoption. But also that is translated into yields or self-reported yields at the end of the period. Yeah. What is important in here, and that's something that we want you to know more, is like, well, yes, so in the first year that we provided all this support, we were helping them to get these mixed blends, we were doing like all these calculations to get the right blend for them. Did they actually, all this effort translated into practice to stick? Because that's one of the main questions. So it's like, do we care about what they do the first season by trying, or do we care about them maintaining these practices in the future? So in the second year, they did not receive any grants. They did not receive more information than the one that we received it. However, we keep following them to try to understand their investments. And we collected information for practices. So the next is what I'm going to show you is the result for the year after intervention. So what do we see? The first thing that we see is that the people who were allowed to choose, they actually stick. We see a statistical significance of a higher statistical significance in adherence to practices, so, which we thought it was very interesting. So not only we see higher take-up of our recommendations the first year, meaning they follow our advice, even if they didn't have to, but in the second year are the ones that are adopting that are adopting these technologies. So that for us is more like a sign that is on something sort of behavioral. Like we might have, by just allowing people to choose whatever they want, like probably we were like, instead of forcing them, like if we were the government, this is your package, that we see that's a sign of like actually like choosing makes a difference for adoption. And this is beyond agricultural theory because the packages were the same. So We see that, for example, that we see adoption of the sewing machinery that is quite expensive. We see they keep having adoption on that. We see adoption of fertilizer at sewing is high also for this group. And also we see higher adoption. All the treatments are using more herbicides, but we see the higher impact in treatment three, the ones we were able to choose. And then the next slide shows, for example, we don't see any change in fertilizers use, but we do see change in smaller practices that actually make the use of the fertilizer more efficient, as covering the fertilizers right after. And all the treatment groups, they have self-reported information that they tried to follow our recommendations. They keep them and they keep using them. And also they desire to use this brand that is called Yara. And the reason why we were using this brand in particular is because we were very worried about that the recommendations itself, need one reason why we want the recommendations to actually, we think they might or not might not be successful is the quality of the fertilizers. So we wanted to control that using a renowned brand of fertilizers that we could guarantee that the concentration was there. So as conclusions so we see that all these efforts of providing farmers with localized information, agricultural services, agro-dealer coordinations, and income grants, this help for adoption. We see high take-up in grants receiving arms, which means especially as Hope was saying, it's probably farmers still need support, so it's not only about information. But something very interesting is we don't see differences in take-up of these packages because we announced the farmers, this is the package based on your individual soil analysis, and then we were very honest with the farmers who received the average recommendations. We don't see any differences, so for farmers, it didn't seem to matter to try. And we also provide income grants are still a problem, but what we think that is very important is since farmers saw the results of all these efforts we did to try to get very standard recommendation that will work for their for them to see these results, these yields actually help them to be more convinced on adopting these practices the next year. And the good thing about these recommendations is that we were trying to move them from efficiency, because all the recommendations, as I said before, were based on, we collected all the information on how much money the farmers were spending on average on fertilizers, and using that money, we based these recommendations. So you were budgeting different. So now we are doing our last round of surveys to see if we, on top of seeing adoption on the second year, we would like to see results on yield, but we don't have those results yet. And that's the end. Thank you very much.